From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The question, what do I do about the Asian jumping worms that are destroying my soil, has outpaced what was the most common thing I was asked year in and year out for decades as a garden writer, the relatively simple challenge of how do I prune my hydrangea? Now gardeners from an ever-widening area of the country are voicing this far more troubling worry about an invasive species that seems to be on a mission of manifest destiny. Today's guest, ecologist Brad Herrick from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, has been studying jumping worms for a decade and is here to share the latest insights. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
Brad is the ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, where the staff first noticed the destructive handiwork of Asian jumping worms in 2013. He's been studying them ever since, and I'm always glad to talk to him, sort of. Welcome back, Brad. I wish we could talk about happier topics someday together.
I know. Someday we will.
I know. Can we talk about a plant or something someday? Oh, my goodness. Remember when we were just gardeners, not warriors, right?
Right.
Yeah. And I learned about the from something, I think it was called Great Lakes Worm Watch Organization. Mm-hmm. I learned about the jumping worms in around 2013. And I contacted you. I don't even remember, you know, how the trail led. I think we first talked in around January 2018. And we've discussed these invasive pests a few times before on the show and so forth, and we can link to some of those transcripts. But just so that people, if people don't know about them, just the really brief version of what are they? Like, what's the main problem that we're talking about?
Jumping worms, or snake worms, as they're commonly referred to, are kind of a new group of segmented earthworms that have made their way over to North America from parts of Asia, primarily Japan and the Korean Peninsula and parts of China. And they're spreading quite quickly and over wide ranges. So they're found right now in about 38 states and several Canadian provinces. And the main concern is that they consume organic matter, which a lot of organisms do, all earthworms do, but they do so in a way that really depletes the organic matter quickly. And so whether it's a forest or your garden, they consume it very rapidly, and then they, through that process, they really change the soil structure and the nutrient and carbon content of those soils. And those are impacts that have cascading effects to our plant health, to other organisms that live in the soil, to carbon that might have been in the soil that now is released into the atmosphere just through their burrowing activities and soil mixing. And it's also important to note that where we're seeing, you know, some of the biggest changes, especially in forests, are in areas that never had native earthworms to begin with. So areas mm-hmm. that, you know, were in the last glaciation, those glaciers, exterminated any native earthworms. So this is like the last 10,000 years or so. And so forests, for example, in the upper Midwest and New England, evolved without the presence of earthworms. And so these are novel critters coming in and really fundamentally changing the ecosystem. And
forest, you say, and that's a place where leaf litter is right. It's the recycling, the natural slow recycling, and all the detritivore type organisms, the helper creatures that do that, turning the organic material that falls down into mm-hmm. back into feeding the soil, and the cycle repeats itself. And it's the basis of all of our really of the environment. So, you know, the soil layer is destroyed. And the thing that's, when you have these worms, as you just said, they do such a quick job of processing the soil, and they turn it to what looks like sort of a cross between coffee grounds and hamburger meat. It's got this, it doesn't have the same tilth as it used to have. And it almost feels like the plants are loose in the soil, you know, things aren't holding. And I think in the past, you've told me that in places like the forests of the Great Lakes and in the Smoky Mountain areas where they are been present a long time, that the saplings can't even get a root hold in because the soil is disturbed in areas where they're very concentrated or something like that.
That's right. So, you know, you have, for example, sugar maple, seedlings, any kind of seedlings, really, woody species, have a hard time getting established in that upper layer of the soil, which is exactly the area that those jumping worms are continuously turning over, incorporating nutrients and making, which you think might be a good thing, incorporate nutrients. But what they're doing is they change the soil, like you suggest, into this coffee ground, like really porous soil. And there's just nothing for the roots to hold on to. And what we find often is that soil is just, it's so erodible because there's nothing holding it in place. It just gets swept away and you're almost left with just mineral soil, which is very inhospitable for a lot of
Yeah. So I had a reader write to me last week, actually, saying, and this was a very, it was a very emotional note. You know, she honestly, she said, I want to sell my house. I want to get away from what I'm seeing. And, you know, very, again, very sincerely said, how are you coping? You know, she said, it's very emotional and it's terrifying. And how do people cope with watching this decimation and feeling powerless? That increasing number, you said 38 states. The last time we spoke a couple of years ago was fewer than that. And and I remember when they first came to your, you noted them on the campus, they moved acres within a short period of time, correct? I mean, they spread, you know, exponentially. So it's heartbreaking, it's terrifying, but what, and I know there's research going on in a lot of different places, but what are you guys, you're a decade in, what are you doing? Are you doing anything? Are you going around, you know, picking up worms and destroying? I mean, what are you doing? Because I know there's different materials that are being suggested to apply and so on and so forth. What are you doing?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, it really depends in terms of control or management of these critters. It really depends on specific and local sort of situation. So whether you're talking about a forest or someone's urban garden, or maybe larger organic garden, it really depends on the situation. And so for us, at the Arboretum here, you know, where we're talking about acres and acres of sugar maple basswood forest being invaded, we're not talking about control anymore. That's not a feasible thing. And we have to accept that. And what's interesting is, you know, we don't really have, we don't really see, just walking through the forest, a change in the vegetation. Now, I have 7 years of data that I'm hopefully analyzing this fall, which may sort of pop out some effects. Specifically in terms of what's happening at the sapling seedling layer. But, you know, like the plants are just one part of the ecosystem. And what happens with earthworms, I think, is that their impact can often be less obvious in the short term than something like spongy moth or EAB. Because they're really changing nutrient cycling and affecting the microbial community and the fungi relationships, all these things that eventually will impact a lot of different things. And so it's hard to kind of talk about the impacts, because while we see some impacts in certain situations, it may be that it's a longer term situation where we'll see impacts later on. Now, that's in our specific urban sugar maple forest. In gardens where we've done some work as well with folks, we're seeing much more of an impact more quickly.
Yes.
But it does, again, depend on the situation. So it seems like for folks that have had jumping worms for 4 or 5 years, where at first they didn't see much of an impact, now they're seeing all sorts of impacts to even plants like hostas, which are like the poster child of hardiness, and transplant them. And again, like transplanting anything into a really porous soil medium is just it's not feasible. And I feel for
my reader. That, sure. Yeah.
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 It's very much an emotional.
Yeah.
Bonds.
Yeah. So, and again, there are research has gone in terms of, and we should say that these are annual mm-hmm. creatures. The adults die in the winter but they leave behind these cocoons of eggs that are so small, they're almost invisible. That's how they perpetuate year to year. And that different, scientists, researchers such as yourself, people have experimented with extremes of heat or cold to kill the cocoons, the overwintering cocoons, or blah, 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 other things to bring the worms to the surface, everything mm-hmm. from mustard powder, and then collect all the worms and kill them in plastic bags in the sun, to fertilizers, natural fertilizers that are not labeled for the purpose, but like tea seed meal, I believe. And then sharp sort of irritating to the skin of these animals, soil amendments like diatomaceous earth and biochar, sort of ground up charcoal, all these things that you read about. But is there any thought that, again, in the garden setting, mm-hmm. That any of this has any, is worth doing? Because none of it's cheap and none of it's easy.
Right.
So you said, we're not talking about control anymore. Anything to say about any of those?
Yeah. Right. So, we're not thinking about control in some of the forest, but, the gardens, it does depend on how invaded your garden is. Like, you can still do a lot of good if you catch an invasion early. And so, like, again, I always kind of harp on like education and understanding what these critters are, knowing identifying changes in your yard. Because there are things, so there's a couple of things that have been researched, relatively new. One is a product that's been on the market for a while called Botanigard.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an entomopathogenic fungus, which is the fungus is called Bouveria bassiana. It's a naturally occurring fungus in the soil. And there's a research paper out now that showed that this product, as well as just the fungus isolate itself, is pretty effective at killing the actual jumping worms. It's as like a granular application that you irrigate in or you spray in.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit of that is that it's already labeled for this use. It's been in the market for a while. It does affect all soft-bodied pest organisms. So there's always that to know about. But that will work. That's an approach with some science behind it. And like you mentioned, we also know that heat works. And, heat is probably the best solution we have right now because it addresses both the live earthworm and its cocoons, which you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Go ahead.
We could solarize.
Yes.
In spring into summer, we could solarize a raised bed, for instance, that we grow vegetables in, let it be fallow, but solarize it, something like that. But we can't do that in a planted ornamental bed that's densely planted. You know what I mean? We can't solarize it. Yeah. So where there are no plants, and agriculturally the same thing would be true, bare soil, I guess.
Right.
We could do that for sure. Or if you want to take everything out of an area, you could do it. But what I find is that they, and I'm probably in the 5-year, you know, mark as well. Mm. And some years, like last year, was very dry here, and it was almost as if they'd gone away. Mm-hmm. And this year, which has been very, very wet, it's as if they've quintupled in a minute, you know. Yeah. And they're prospering. And it's not the same year to year, even in the same place. And the population explosion, though, seems, you know, it's pretty impressive. I mean, they really move.
That's what's sort of disheartening is, you know, we're in our second year in the Midwest here of drought, and our numbers are way down.
That's exactly what happened here last year.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yep. And then you can mention you guys have had a lot of precipitation this year. And
yes,
that just shows that, you know, what's happening is those cocoons are forming a cocoon bank where they're not going to hatch until the conditions are
correct.
Ideal. And so, you know, one year might look great. It's like, oh, I've taken care of them. This drought took care of them. And next year, like you're saying, you see a quintuple of earthworms coming out. That's because those cocoons are able to rehydrate and hatch again. So, yeah, it's really frustrating in that sense. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, solarization if or some other heat treatment that can get hotter, you know, hotter than just, you know, the ambient air temperature.
Yes.
Where it not only dries them out, but it actually kills them. Even, you know, folks are using, you know, things like torches, or I'm thinking about how do you steam the soil, sterilize it?
Well, people with greenhouses do that. I mean, if they get a fungal pathogen in a greenhouse, you know, like my flower farming friends nearby, they're organic farmers, they can't use most fungicides. So they have to rent a steamer. Yeah, exactly. Right. But, you know, but for our basic garden, so the botanic garden is one possibility, but some of these other, either these sort of irritants or the tea seed meal or whatever, is that just going to bring them to the surface? Is that the idea of that as well? I don't really know what it does or if it has any efficacy or not, you know?
Right. So the tea seed meal, similarly with, you know, people have been using a kind of a mixing of vinegar and water, or like soap and water.
I've seen mustard powder and water being recommended too.
Mustard powder and water. Yeah. So that the mustard powder and water and the tea seed meal will bring them to the surface. Mustard powder will not kill them, but the tea seed meal will, as will the vinegar and water and the soap and water.
Yeah.
We don't think that the tea seed meal impacts like the plants at all, which is a good thing. Same with the mustard powder, but the vinegar and soap water could very well. And that's the other, there's always a trade-off.
Well, and it depends on where you apply it. So again, if it's along your walkway and it's among the cracks in the pavers, okay, you could probably do the vinegar, et cetera. But
you want to stay away from the plant root zone.
Right. Yeah. It's a pretty gruesome experience. Also, I will say, the collecting of worm bodies. Fragrant. It's also extremely fragrant in summer. And the other thing is, and this is really like crazy, but to think about, but I do think about it, is so again, those adults are going to die anyway in the winter. They're annual organisms.
Yep.
So at a certain point, those cocoons have already been laid, or whatever the word is, you know. Yeah. So you could put lots of this stuff on and gather up all these hideous, smelly dead worms that are decaying and so forth. But they've left their mark, haven't they? So I guess this would be a multi-year thing to do until you diminished the adult population to the point where you didn't have as many cocoons. It would be a multi-year. It wouldn't be a one and done at all.
That's right. That's an important message, Margaret, that it's not. And this is the case with any invasive species, frankly.
I agree. Yes.
It's hardly ever a one and done thing. It's a multi-year process. And what you're basically wanting to do is deplete that cocoon bank over a number of years. And, you know, I think that's the way to look at it. And I could see that in theory being effective, depending on how large of a scale you're working at. At some point, this becomes too labor intensive, maybe. But yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. And there's things that are really labor intensive, like physical barriers. Driving in, like, there's experiments that have experimented with jumping worms in forests by putting in like metal flashing little quadrats to experiment with. Like, they don't want jumping worms going into these quadrats. They're testing the soil without them. And so, putting that kind of physical barrier in down to like 6 inches, so they're not, because these are only surface dwelling earthworms, so they're not usually going to go very deep. And so if you're like, my neighbor has them, I don't want them, you could spend some time and put some kind of physical barrier around your raised bed.
A worm fence. Underground, though.
Probably extreme, but it's something that could be done.
Yeah. So we have maybe 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure to talk about the other side of the equation of what to do and the powerlessness and the worry and so forth. And I've read different things about this. Is, do I add mulch at the times when in other words, do I feed them, quote unquote, more organic material, or do I just leave them there in their degraded soil, or do I add more soil on top of where the soil has receded? Or what about that? What about we have our usual methods of caring for our soil and garden beds, but what do you think about that? Feed them, don't feed them?
That is the question. I would say, mulch is the food for these critters, but really, like, at the end of the day, we want to be able to enjoy our gardens. We want to garden, and by enjoying our gardens, we want to make sure that the plants are as healthy as they can be.
Yes.
And, mulch is a really important part of that. And
yes, serves other purposes. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. And, one thing to try is experimenting with different types of mulch. So all mulch, all organic matter is not created equal, right? So leaf mulch has a very low, depending on the type of leaves, has a lower carbon to nitrogen ratio than something like grass mulch or hay mulch. So it's the leaves break down faster, and the earthworms are able to consume it more readily. Whereas like native grass mulch or hay or straw mulch, even pine mulch,
needles
aren't going to break down as fast and aren't as palatable to jumping worms or any earthworms. And so trying some different types of mulch, I think, is a good first step to see, hey, maybe I found something that doesn't, sticks around for a while and the earthworms don't do as well. Otherwise, that's one option. The other option is just stick with, if you already have them, stick with, your mulch system, that will at least maybe the benefit of the mulch will outweigh the negative part of the earthworms, and those plants will still be able to do okay and persist. So it's like too much of a good thing will overcome a negative thing.
Yeah. That's the direction I've gone, because I can't watch the, you may have a beautiful established tree and suddenly it's got surface roots because the soil's receded. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, well, not that I'm going to bury the tree and suffocate it. I don't mean that, but I want to keep it at the level it was at.
One thing that I've just started to think a little bit about is, as we learn more about which plants, which plant families, which plant traits are more susceptible to jumping worms, we might think about, where these jumping worms come from, which are, parts of Asia. And are there ornamentals from that part of the world that might be just fine coexisting with jumping worms? And that maybe we think about shifting some of our garden targets to plants that do just fine in the presence of all sorts of disturbances, and maybe not the ones that we've traditionally wanted to garden, but maybe there's an opportunity for some new gardening ideas and practices.
Yeah.
You know, at some point we have to probably accept some level of this jumping worm pressure, at least on in some of our gardens, and see how we can adapt to that, which is not always what people want to hear, but.
But it's realistic because, again, the first few years we were talking more about like, okay, don't spread them, don't share plants, don't do this, don't do that.
Right.
But I mean, in my region in New England, I mean, I'm hearing from people everywhere who have them. It's super widespread. And similarly, I think in the area adjacent to where you are, there's a lot of, Well, Brad Herica from University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. I mean, like I said, I want you to tell me, you should email me and tell me what your favorite plant is, and we'll do an episode on that instead of talking about these damn worms all the time.
Sounds like a deal.
Okay. And thank you so much for making time. I know you're swamped, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening, worms or otherwise.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.